This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on Tuesday, the 11th of March 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme, we'll have the latest developments in the ongoing search for Malaysia Airlines Flight MH370. Our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, will be joining me live. Also ahead, 25 years since Pan Am Flight 103 was destroyed over the Scottish town of Lockerbie. New revelations suggest it was Iranian plot rather than a Libyan operation, as has long been believed. Martin Plout, fellow at the Institute for Commonwealth Studies, and Robert Fox, defence correspondent for London's Evening Standard newspaper, will be joining me to assess the implications. Then we'll head to Berlin to hear from author Rory McLean about the city's appeal to creative minds and its unrivaled capacity for reinvention.
The individual goes there, and yeah, maybe he's not a Christopher Isherwood, or maybe she's not Marlene Dietrich, but in a small part of that city, they can recreate themselves.
All that, plus we'll check in with one of our correspondents around the world, and before the hour is out. We'll be bringing you our weekly review of some of the hottest music releases. That's all ahead on today's edition of Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A very busy 60 minutes ahead of us here at Midori House in London. Before we commence, though, let's be brought up to speed with the latest world news. Here today is James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. Within the past 15 minutes, a senior Malaysian Air Force official has said the last known location of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 has been traced to a spot above Pulau Perak, a very small island in the Straits of Malacca and hundreds of miles from the usual Kuala Lumpur to Beijing flight path. The official declined to be named because he's not authorised to speak to the media. If the Malaysian Air Force data cited by the source is correct, the aircraft was flying the opposite direction from its scheduled destination and on the opposite side of the Malay Peninsula from its scheduled route. Previous accounts had the aircraft losing touch with air traffic control near the coast of Vietnam. In other developments, officials investigating the disappearance say two men travelling on stolen passports were Iranians, with no apparent links to terrorist groups. Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing went missing on Saturday after taking off with 239 people on board. We'll bring you more on this story straight after this news bulletin with Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé. The European Commission has agreed to extend nearly €500 million worth of trade benefits to Ukraine, removing import duties on a wide range of agricultural goods, textiles and other goods in an effort to support the Ukrainian economy. Speaking at the European Parliament in Strasbourg, European Commission President José Manuel Barroso said the trade benefits would take the shape of unilateral trade provisions. The agreement is expected to come into effect on November the 1st, by which time Barroso said he expects the European Union to have signed the political aspects of a free trade deal with a new government in Ukraine.
But let me stress that economic support is just a part, an important part, but just a part of our broader efforts to support Ukraine in the current difficult circumstances. Let me recall that as a matter of priority, the European has decided to sign the political chapters of the cessation agreement in Ukraine before the 25th of May, so before the elections.
The former Egyptian foreign minister and presidential candidate Amr Moussa says his country's leaders should leave the door open for the outlawed Muslim Brotherhood to re-enter politics if the group accepts the constitution. As head of the body that rewrote the country's constitution, Moussa believes democracy includes roles for Brotherhood supporters, provided they peacefully abide by the new document approved by more than 90% of voters in January.
I see the future emanating from one fact, that this constitution did not exclude any citizen, any group, any current political or anything of that kind from the full enjoyment of rights, contrary to what the constitution adopted under the Muslim Brotherhood has stipulated. They excluded so many of the members of the previous regime to them.
The Brotherhood, largely driven underground, has survived repression under one Egyptian autocratic regime after another, relying on a vast network of social services to win grassroots support. Libya's parliament has dismissed Prime Minister Ali Zeidan after a tanker laden with oil from a rebel-held port reportedly broke through a naval blockade. MPs called a vote of confidence in Mr. Zeidan after they were told the North Korean-flagged ship had escaped to sea. A friend of Oscar Pistorius has told his murder trial that the athlete had a big love for guns. Darren Fresco said that he'd been with him on two occasions when a gun had been fired in public. Mr. Pistorius had once accidentally fired a gun in a restaurant, but made him take the blame, Mr. Fresco said. And the head of the US Senate Intelligence Committee has publicly accused the CIA of improperly accessing computers used by congressional staff. Senator Dianne Feinstein said on the Senate floor that such activities may have undermined the constitutional framework of government oversight. The Senate panel was investigating allegations of abuse during a CIA detention and interrogation program. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, James. More news, of course. James will return with the world news headlines for us at the bottom of the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we'll be back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.07 exactly, 14.07 in New York City. Now, I'm joined in studio by two guests. As always, I have the pleasure to welcome Martin Plaut, fellow at the Institute for Commonwealth Studies, and Robert Fox, defence correspondent for London's Evening Standard newspaper. And we'll be hearing from them both in a moment. But as James Luckhurst was telling us in the news, we begin with the latest developments in the search for Malaysia Air Flight MH370. And we'll cross to our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, in Taipei, who has been digesting this most recent news. Tyler, welcome to the programme. Good to speak with you as always, of course. We understand that the plane has deviated hundreds of kilometres off course. The Malaysian military tracked it through the Straits of Malacca above a tiny island, Pulau Perak. What do you make of these latest revelations, and what are people where you are telling you about them too?
Well, there's a couple of things here. I think one, the first thing it opens up is obviously what else does Malaysia know? Because we have to rewind to almost when this happened, probably in the first 12 or 18 hours. Well, sort of broke, Tom, there was already the sort of slight hint that someone was saying within the Air Force, within civil aviation, that this aircraft might have turned around. So we've been living with that for the last 4 days. Earlier today, we had heard via our correspondent in Bangkok that there was mumbling that that this was going to happen. The story has now broken properly that indeed this plane has made something of a turn. Of course, a lot of questions now still. You know, many people asking is this indeed sabotage? Was it a suicide mission on the side of the pilot? But I was talking to someone a little bit earlier, actually from Malaysia, a pilot, and he had quite a straightforward and simple explanation for it. And in fact, as we've sort of looked at, indeed, the new trajectory of this aircraft, his story actually becomes more interesting, and it's quite simple. If there was a massive decompression on the aircraft, something happened. So if you're flying at 35,000 feet, if suddenly there is, you know, a massive decompression, what happens is the aircraft will automatically make something close to a 90-degree turn. Every civil aircraft, every private aircraft will do this and will drop to about 10,000 feet. So it gets out of the way of other aircraft in the major airwaves. Now, if you look at actually, indeed, where this aircraft, where we lost, let's say, traditional air radar coverage with it, you know, it's not quite 90 degrees, but it's very close. You also have probably, if you're then on secondary power sources with that type of decompression, it would probably get you 45 minutes, 50 minutes away. And this is probably about the point where we lose this aircraft. So one explanation still could be indeed mechanical and obviously a very horrific decompression on board.
Those are fascinating insights from Tyler Brulé, our editor-in-chief in Taipei. Tristan McAllister is also on the line, our transport editor who's in San Francisco. Tristan, how does that sound to you? I mean, that's a credible explanation. It seems to tally with some of the other mysterious, or what we thought were mysterious incidents we'd witnessed in this case.
You know, Tom, I think it actually makes a lot of sense, given what Tyler just said. You know, there's a lot of mystery here, and I think the assumption is that someone turned that airplane to get it to go off course. Now, the mystery really comes from the fact that the authorities really haven't been telling us much. It's been really murky as to what exactly happened right after the plane disappeared, and now we're finding that it's way off course. You know, I think a lot of people are assuming that someone turned the airplane and had an intention to sort of take it somewhere else. But the idea of a decompression, and thus in a situation like that, if there's not oxygen readily available, people tend to fall asleep. So, you know, if that is indeed the case, it could mean that mechanical failure was behind that. But still, we have to think really, really hard about exactly where these facts are coming from. Now, you know, of course, the Malaysian authorities have every interest in keeping this as close to the vest as possible, especially if something did go terribly wrong with the pilot or anyone on the crew. I mean, if there was any sort of malintent here, the airline is a flag carrier. It is essentially run by the government. So they have an interest in making sure they keep this information as close to them as possible until they really know what happened.
Well, we'll keep a very close eye on all developments and bring them to you as soon as we can. Those are the insights of Tristan McAllister, our transport editor in San Francisco, and Tyler Brulé, our editor-in-chief in Taipei. Thanks to them both. I am joined here in the studio by Martin Plaut and Robert Fox, as I mentioned. Gentlemen, just before we move on, very briefly to ask you for your insights on this particular story. It's obviously very difficult to second guess. As Tyler and Tristan were alluding to there, these pieces of information come out very slowly. Do you have any particular sort of concerns about either the way this was reported initially or how the information has been sort of dripping out to us? Any particular things that stand out, Martin, in your mind?
I think the obvious question is, why have the Malaysians sat on this story for so long? Why have they, you know, not made this available immediately? It's most peculiar. As for people falling asleep because they have lack of oxygen, that doesn't sound very plausible, because after all, you know, surely the pilots, if anyone, have oxygen available to them. So, you know, I think this is still a very open question.
Robert, do you go along with that? Do we just have to wait and see, perhaps?
Yeah, if it was so far off course, as it appears to be, why was there no report of it being off course? And they're sort of throwing hands in the air and it's all a great mystery and we don't know, and looking out over acres of sea and then coming back to this remote island. I'm absolutely with Martin here. I think that, are the Malaysian authorities sitting on something that they really don't want to say? Because I can't believe that had the plane deviated for so long that there was no contact with a ground station or with a station at any point. And I should imagine that there are people sitting in Beijing who are pretty livid about all of this. And I think that for the Malaysians, it's going to be, there's a lot of explaining to do. And they seem, with the reluctance that they're coming forward with the information, they seem to be trying to get away with explaining away, and we've heard a few explanations away just now, and I think the falling asleep actually doesn't hold up either.
Well, we'll be following that story and bringing our listeners all the latest, particularly on tonight's Monocle Daily, which will be at 2200 hours London time, of course. The difficulties, I suppose, implicit in piecing together, literally and metaphorically, the aftermath of this sort of incident in the skies are evident. You know, whenever we see incidents like this, they're evident in historical cases too, none more so perhaps than the Lockerbie bombing of Pan Am Flight 103, of course. Interesting new developments on this case. There was a Libyan national who had been prosecuting this country. There were a lot of claim and counterclaims about the sort of validity or not of that prosecution. And we're seeing now more fresh documentary claims to have seen US defense intelligence cables suggesting the involvement of the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine General Command and various of their operatives throughout the region. Martin, if I can start with you, it is interesting, isn't it? We saw Libya for many years, this was a sort of political football kick between them. Gaddafi actually sort of took responsibility belatedly and made a sort of compensation payout, though a lot of people suggested there were other motivations behind that. What do you make with these latest revelations? Some of them have kind of been emerging piecemeal over a number of years, of course.
Well, indeed. And I think that the Lockerbie bombing, which was obviously, you know, the worst terrorist atrocity Britain ever suffered, it feels a bit like the death of Kennedy. You're never going to get to the bottom of it. Absolutely never. Why is this story coming out now? Why has someone like Robert Baer, who is the CIA officer, who is quoted in the Al Jazeera documentary, which is really the one that has unearthed all of this, why is he talking about it now? Why has he waited all this time? Why have all these people all of a sudden come out of the woodwork? And why has Al Jazeera decided this is the moment they want to put it out? I'm sorry, I am no specialism on this whatsoever, but the whole thing feels most peculiar. And it also, of course, comes at a moment when the Iranians and the Europeans are beginning to mend fences, and now all of a sudden the Iranians are back in the dock for possibly Lockerbie bombing. There's just something peculiar about the whole thing from beginning to end. But when I spoke to some Palestinians that I know, and I talked to them about the PFLP General Command, they said, "Oh yes, they were definitely in the picture all along." But if they knew all this, why has nobody been talking about it or in plausible way that it could be put into a documentary? So I just find the whole thing impenetrable.
Peculiarity after peculiarity, Robert. You have a little more, I guess, insight into the workings of some of these corridors of power, as murkily as they are described by Martin there. Is there a credible reason why some of this would emerge now? Or do you share to a large part Martin's
concerns? No, I don't
share
Martin's view at all. Almost none of it. That PFLP-GC was in the frame from the beginning. And so too was the Syrian connection, the Syrian outsourcing. The late Paul Foote worked on that. It was very, very difficult to nail down Jibril. And in fact, it was amazing that, you know, how the BBC had difficulty with it. I was defence correspondent at The Telegraph at the time, talked to Jim Swire. And it seemed to be pretty clear what was going on. By the way, the thing that came up in the Megrahi trial, the man who was actually convicted by a Scottish court, of preparing or helping the preparation of the bomb via Malta, that was regarded with the greatest scepticism. But I think Megrahi was terribly helpful in all of this. I think he was a really, really important figure. Now, I'll tell you what's happened. I happen to know Bill Cran and Chris Jeans very, very well indeed. In fact, I've known Bill Cran for 50 years. He's one of my oldest friends. He's an extremely distinguished producer and director. He put George Bull, as in Supergran, away. He revealed Mrs. Marcos's shoes. Sorry to repress that laugh, but his wonderful documentary showed first that. Bill has been following this with great difficulty for 3 or 4 years because in the world of journalism, he and I occupy from a very different slightly different corner, but complementary. It's like the policeman who knows jolly well, but you cannot get that missing link. And particularly when there's such a pushback from the US and the UK, and as we get from here, George H.W. Bush, Thatcher, they were very keen to be nice to the Assad regime. You might say God knows why now, but it was the depth of the Cold War. That happened. What we really wanted to do was to get to the beginning of the snake or the ladder. And that starts, which we all realised it did, with the downing of the Iranian Airbus with 290 people aboard by mistake by an extremely trigger-happy captain on a missile cruiser called the Vincennes in the Gulf in August 1988. It was a terrible problem. That's where the trail starts. This is what Bill has put together. Where he has been very fortunate is in getting the testimony. I don't think he's met him in prima persona, but I think they've got the documents of Abu Ghassem Masbahi, an absolutely crucial Iranian operative. And so he's joined the dots. The dots that many of us have realised were there, but quite how they fitted together, to mix a metaphor, we didn't know. Now, why Al Jazeera? No, it's not a plot. The problem is that the BBC bottled out on this. The BBC would have been the natural destiny, but what with Newsnight and hoo-ha and we don't do this, and it was a big budget number because it's going out in the US as well, and Sky is in on it. This is a film that jolly nearly didn't get made, and it's not from the motivation of Al Jazeera English language that did it. That was almost, you know, the port of last resort, and once they got that deal to do it, they could put it together. But the man I salute in this, and I think that I hope wherever he is, that he takes his hat off to Bill and Chris, is Paul Foot, because Paul Foot did a very good dossier, which got half the story. And I must say that it's not just a journalism. There was the indefatigable Dr. Jim Swire, whose 23-year-old daughter died in Pan Am 103. He was very supportive. The thing that's wonderful about Jim is that Jim will tell you when he's followed a false trail. He's been part of it, and I'm delighted that this has happened. And okay, it may be inconvenient for power politics and trying to get to be nice to the Iranians, but they interviewed one of the Gaddafi sons during the case, and it was absolutely clear that this was appalling what they got the Libyans to do, and Gaddafi did it. There's no mad fox is completely mad, that Gaddafi did it because he wanted to get rid of those crippling sanctions. And that's why he said, I put my hand up and offer the compensation.
Those are the insights of Robert Fox. Before that, we were hearing from Martin Plough. They're both still with me, and they'll stay here when we return in a moment or two to unpick a diplomatic wrangle involving South Africa and Rwanda. Stay tuned for that.
Monocle has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle shop.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 22 minutes past the hour here in London. Still with me, Martin Plough, fellow at the Institute for Commonwealth Studies, and Robert Fox of the London Evening Standard newspaper. Now, we're turning our sights next to an intriguing diplomatic spat. I don't know if intriguing is perhaps the right word. Rwanda and South Africa. Rwanda has, Martin, I'll start with you, what should we call it, a questionable track record of interventions overseas, various allegations of, you know, doing away with people the regime doesn't like, including the suggestions an opponent in a hotel in Johannesburg. South Africa responded, of course, by banning diplomats. I believe claims were privy to that information in Pretoria. Rwanda has responded in kind by expelling South African diplomats. Where do you see this sort of... is there a clear fault in this situation? Is it a diplomatic expression of a much more serious problem? Where does Rwanda's questionable foreign policy begin and end, in your view?
Oh, it begins and ends with the Rwandan genocide. The Tutsis and Paul Kagame are determined to hang on to power at all costs forever, although they're only 15% of the population. And frankly, that is the beginning of the entire problem. Paul Kagame is prepared to do anything, anywhere, anytime to hang on to that power. Now, I happen to have spoken to General Faustin Niamwasa, who is the man who was he's been shot once in the stomach, he's nearly been killed twice. His number two, Patrick Karegeya, was assassinated in a hotel in Johannesburg. I have here a threat to life notice, which it was issued in 2011 in London. And it says, reliable intelligence states that the Rwandan government poses an imminent threat to your life. This is to exiles in London. What's happening on the streets of London? The Rwandan government is prepared to kill anyone who stands in their way. And the biggest threat was the general, because he was a Tutsi. He had broken with Paul Kagame, and he therefore was rallying support amongst the Tutsis against Paul Kagame. He was a huge threat to Kagame's regime, and he was prepared to do anything. And he has made it clear he's quite happy to see him dead, although he denies this particular allegation. And that's why South Africa finally, after the third attempt on his life, expelled the diplomats, because they were the ones behind it.
I mean, it's worth pondering that things like this threat of life notice. I mean, what is the status? I mean, remind us of the sort of diplomatic relations, for example, even in Britain. This is to a citizen who's actually on British soil.
Indeed.
Why are there not more sort of draconian measures to deal then with Rwanda from governments all around the world?
Because everybody backs down when the Rwandans say, but we were, you know, do you want to side with the genocidists? And everybody says, oh my goodness, no. Plus, you mustn't forget that the Conservative Party has launched its... In the British Conservative Party launched its... David Cameron launched their entire development strategy in Rwanda. They have very close links with the Rwandan regime. And someone like Mitchell, who was the development secretary, frankly, was prepared to go to almost any length not to impose sanctions on them. On his last day in office, without consulting his own officials, he went in and he reversed the sanctions, the mild sanctions which have been placed on Rwanda for precisely these kind of activities.
Robert, this sounds like one of those kind of stories where nobody really emerges with very much credit. You know, pretty bleak. People who are motivated by self-interest go to almost, you know, astonishing lengths. Where does it end? Because as Martin's made pretty clear there, you've got people who are very committed to retaining their hold on power at almost any cost. Should we just prepare to continue to see diplomatic spats as, I guess, the least evil that we see when it comes to these sorts of people?
No, I think we should take Martin's point that this is completely unacceptable. I think that governments, particularly through foreign aid programs, I'm talking about UK governments, have not behaved as they should have done. OK, this may be the third time of asking, but at least it is something that South Africa has at last moved on this. Mm. And I don't know the area. I don't know, but I follow the subject, but merely as a sort of lay reader, if I could put it like that. But I agree with the overall view that people have been far too soft on Kagame, because Kagame has held up this big placard that, you know, it's either stability, it's either me or chaos again. And he's behaved in this outrageous way. But this thing of threatening people by the violent side of diplomacy, threatening to use embassies as basis to kill people, to maim people, to make them unpersons. Of course, that was exactly the problem that we have faced, and we're going to discuss some of it now, at different times with Russia since the end of the Cold War, and above all, Libya. And the thing breaks down with this. I mean, I think that I applaud what South Africa has done. And to see this kind of mood, and this is the way you're going to have to deal with Kagame. So there's going to be an awful lot of labour ahead.
Just briefly on that point then, Martin, what do you expect to see with Kagame as we look into sort of middle distant future? Will he retain his grip at all costs? Do you think that it's possible to galvanise, you know, Western countries and other actors on this to make some action that might be slightly more effective in limiting these worst excesses of his regime?
I don't think so. I mean, this is an existential threat to him. And to his regime, and he runs a very effective government in terms of economy. I mean, they are wonderful. They've done a tremendous job in getting growth in Rwanda, and there's very little outside pressure that you can really bring to bear on them.
A slightly bleak picture, perhaps, painted by Martin Platt there, talking about the situation in Rwanda. Gentlemen, the clock is against us. The clock is ticking. We're running out of time. But I wanted to ask you about one final subject before I release you from Studio One. New Zealand. Now, it's holding supposedly a referendum within the next few years on whether to change its national flag. Now, obviously, our listeners will be well aware that there's certain elements of the flag that perhaps don't sit as comfortably with New Zealand's view of itself on the world stage. A slightly kind of light-hearted look, but there's, I guess, a serious point at the heart of this. Robert, if I start with you, I mean, does it really matter what a flag tells you about a nation? Aren't there more important nation branding issues to address rather than just that small square? Or does it actually still represent something more important than that?
It says something about a nation like New Zealand that it wraps itself round the axles with its flag, ha ha, but it really is rather silly. Flags, I find upsetting through my time. You know, the Flags and Emblems Act in Northern Ireland, hell of a problem, still hell of a problem there. Just look at the stuff that we've seen with Ukraine, with the, in centres like Donetsk, hauling one flag up one minute and the other. Really, are you going to conduct your politics on such tokens? Well, people, I think, some of the followers of Mr. Putin and some of the fascists on the other side quite clearly do. And I think it's very worrying. Very interesting this morning, the foreign minister of Australia, who's over here, and you would expect them because they've talked about being a republic. And she said, no, why bother? And she made a very important point about, and they're rather similar, and they both have the Union flag. And it said a lot of Australians over the past century died under that flag. Why should we change it?
Martin, do you go along with that? I mean, it's interesting. Rob highlights those recent cases where, you know, the flags have been absolutely fundamental to, you know, various geopolitical arguments. Do you think it's maybe wrong of New Zealand to sort of weigh in on it when their issues are maybe not as immediate? Or do you think it's a legitimate point?
Well, as a German citizen with South African background, I feel a bit difficult to comment on it. But let me say this: I'm a passionate supporter of the Commonwealth. I think Commonwealth is a great idea, and I love the history. But you know, I think the flag is I couldn't tell the difference between the New Zealand and the Australian flag. And frankly, I think the suggestion of having essentially the all black colours, in other words, the black with the silver fern on it, is a wonderful one. I mean, after all, you know, the Canadians had a flag which was similar to the New Zealand's and the Australians. They now have the beautiful maple leaf.
Yeah.
And it is fabulous. And so I'm all in favour of it.
You grow into your flag, do you say, Martin?
Yes. I mean, look at South Africa. We got the Y front flag. It's a beautiful flag. Has it made us any less part of the Commonwealth? No.
Of course not.
Those are the thoughts of Martin Plaut, fellow at the Institute for Commonwealth Studies, and Robert Fox, a defence correspondent for London's Evening Standard newspaper. Gentlemen, thank you both very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦，这是 Monaco 24。Orlando,
du er Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette er Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando,
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
This is Monaco 24.
Yes, you're listening to Monocle 24. This is Midori House, and there's plenty still ahead in the second half of today's programme. We'll check in with one of our correspondents around the world, speak to the author whose new book claims to reimagine Berlin, and before the end of the programme... We'll bring you our weekly review of some of the top music releases. Before we get started on all that, though, let's be brought up to speed with the latest world news headlines. Here's James Luckhurst.
A senior Malaysian Air Force official has said the last known location of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 has been traced to a spot above Pulau Perak, a very small island in the Straits of Malacca and hundreds of miles from the usual Kuala Lumpur to Beijing flight path. The official declined to be named because he's not authorised to speak to the media. If the Malaysian Air Force data cited by the source is correct, the aircraft was flying the opposite direction from its scheduled destination and on the opposite side of the Malay Peninsula from its scheduled route. In other news, the European Commission has agreed to extend nearly €500 million worth of trade benefits to Ukraine, removing import duties on a wide range of agricultural goods and textiles. Former Egyptian Foreign Minister and presidential candidate Amr Moussa says his country's leaders should leave the door open for the outlawed Muslim Brotherhood to re-enter politics if the group accepts the constitution. Libya's parliament has dismissed Prime Minister Ali Zeidan after a tanker laden with oil from a rebel-held port reportedly broke through a naval blockade. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, James. James Luckhurst will be back, of course, with a full bulletin of world news for you at the top of the next hour. That's 1900 hours here in London. You're listening to Midori House, though. Live on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we're heading to the Colombian capital, Bogota. Our correspondent there is Anastasia Maloney, and I'm delighted to say she joins me now. Anastasia, welcome to the programme. Great to speak with you, as always. We'll begin, I guess, with the parliamentary elections held over the weekend, of course. The presidential election campaign heats up. Tell us what you made of what we saw.
Well, the parliamentary elections were really seen as a test for the current president, Juan Manuel Santos, and people were really looking to see how much of a vote he would get and to what extent he'd keep his majority in Congress. And his majority was diminished, but he still is the biggest force in Colombian politics. He's got a coalition of three main parties and they still control 40% of the Congress. So he did well. And that's seen as a positive sign for him to carry on with the election campaign. He's up for re-election. He's looking to get elected for the second time for another 4-year term. And so this will boost his hopes when Colombians go to the polls yet again on the 21st of May. However, he's going to have a lot of opposition and quite a fight from the main opposition party. And that actually comes from the former Colombian president, Álvaro Uribe. He's now got himself elected as a senator, and his opposition party won 19 seats in the Senate. So that's going to become a really important opposition force in Colombian Parliament, in the Congress and in the Senate. And it's seen as almost like a tea party that he's got going there. And he'll be there to basically make Santos's life incredibly difficult and oppose the peace process that's currently taking place in Havana with the FARC rebels.
I'll ask you a little bit more about the peace talks in a moment, though. Who else is in the presidential frame then? I mean, are there other candidates or is it likely to be, a sort of a bit of a procession for Santos, do you think?
I think Santos will have his work cut out. He's still the front runner. He's likely to win, according to current polls, in the second round of voting. But he'll be facing his main rival, which is Oscar Zuluaga, who's a conservative candidate from the Centre Democratic Party, which is backed by the former President Uribe. He's considered a weak candidate, but with the latest election results in the parliamentary elections, they've got 19 seats, as I said. So they still are important, and lots of Colombians, over 2 million Colombians, voted for them. So Zuluaga could gain votes ahead during the presidential campaign. And also there's a familiar name, the ex-mayor of Bogota, Enrique Peñalosa. He's also running for the presidency. There's a few other candidates representing left-wing parties, but generally most people at the moment expect Santos to win.
Absolutely. Well, we'll keep a weather eye on that one. You mentioned those peace talks, of course, a little earlier. One almost loses count of sort of which round of peace talks that we're in between the government and the FARC rebels. Just dragging on, what's the sense where you are, Anastasia? I mean, is there a feeling that we are inching towards some kind of progress here?
There is some feeling that there is progress being made, but they really are dragging on. The talks now on their 21st round, they've been going on since November 2012. The president had certainly hoped for more progress at this stage. They've reached two partial agreements on two of the 5 points on the peace negotiating agenda. But the last round of talks last week, they failed to reach any sort of agreement or announcement. Usually, at the end of each round, the two sides produce a joint announcement and give some sort of hope that the next bit is going to be agreed upon, but they didn't do that this time. And there is a feeling among Colombians that they are for peace, but around sort of 30% of Colombians don't believe that these peace talks are actually going to reach some sort of conclusion and get a peace accord signed. So there's a lot of apathy, pessimism, and almost indifference among Colombians at the moment about this peace process.
That doesn't sound like very good news. Just briefly, I wonder, Anastasia, I mean, is it the usual sort of the old chestnuts that are causing problems, drug trafficking and the issue of drugs and who's controlling the drugs trade is frequently held up as one such obstacle in the path. Is that remaining sort of front and centre in terms of one of the things that the two sides can't agree on?
Well, at the moment, the topic that they are discussing is the issue of drug trafficking, as you said. And I think the stumbling block is that the FARC still have not admitted that they are major drug traffickers, which the Colombian government and the US government believe that they are. And they can't seem to agree on the best way to compensate farmers who grow coca, which is the raw ingredient for cocaine. How are they going to be compensated? What is the government going to do to ensure that they can earn a living in a different way? And these talks, this particular issue of drug trafficking, does involve the Americans behind closed doors and their secret involvement in these negotiations. And so instead of the two sides usually just talking, there is, according to the Colombian press, a whole delegation, not in Havana, but a whole delegation involved from America in this issue, because it certainly does affect the US, because a lot of the cocaine that Colombia produces ends up on the streets of the US. So it does tie in very much with US-Colombian relations and foreign policy. So I think that's one of the reasons why this particular round has failed to produce any results, because it's so complicated.
We'll have to keep a very close eye on it. Anastasia, thanks very much for bringing us up to speed with events there. That's Anastasia Maloney, Monocle's Bogota correspondent. Thanks as ever for joining us. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Up next on the programme, we'll speak to the author whose new book reimagines Berlin. That's coming up right after this.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take five times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, 1841 here in London. But it's to Berlin that we head next. A city of fragments, a city divided and reunited, a place that's been reborn as a creative centre after a century scarred by conflict. The author, Rory MacLean, is one of those souls to have fallen for its unique charms. And he set out to document the city, to tell its story in his own unique way, in a series of biographical profiles of some of the dazzling cast that's defined the city over more than 500 years. A little earlier, I caught up with Rory to talk about his book, Berlin, Imagine a City. I began by asking him why he finds the place defined by volatility such a compelling location.
We're used to cities having a myth, having an aura about them. You know, London is forever trendy, and New York is all about energy, and Lourdes is about devotion, and Berlin is volatility. No other city has been so powerful and fallen so low, especially in the 20th century. No other capital has been so feared, so hated, so loved. And no other city has had to constantly reinvent itself, or has constantly reinvented itself, over the last 500 years. 500 years ago, it was nothing. Places like Würzburg and Frankfurt an Oder were more important cities than Berlin. It was this backwater. And from the beginning, Berlin had to constantly reinvent itself, first to become something, because its land was very poor. It's built on very sandy soil. So to build up its power, it had to go out and take things.
Tell me about then charting that progress, because obviously writing a sort of a biography of a city that is characterised by so much change, is that why you wanted to take this sort of episodic approach and this character-driven approach?
It's people I care about. I'm a travel writer, but I'm, if you like, not a geographer of place, but a geographer of the human heart is how I see it. So I'm interested in people. I'm interested in individuals. I'm fascinated how individuals change a place, how they change the world we live in. An individual has an idea sitting in their garret. They write it, or they paint it, or they record it, put it out there, and it changes the world. And that, I find that so, so moving. Specifically related to Berlin, there are many very fine, what shall we say, traditional histories of Berlin. I couldn't begin to write one of those. I wanted to write about the individuals who had made Berlin, who had, through their creativity, had created the city over these 500, 600 years. So the book is a series of 24, I think, short portraits of the 24 creative, and I put that in quotes, individuals, because it is people like Christopher Isherwood and David Bowie and Marlene Dietrich and Leni Riefenstahl, but also people like Joseph Goebbels. He was evil, dark, but a very creative individual. He came up with the Nazi iconography, which so many of us foreigners now, or so many foreigners now go to Berlin looking for.
It's interesting you mention him there, of course, and we have Albert Speer in there as well. And people understand about the sort of impact that Nazism had on the fabric of Berlin when it came to monumentalist building and that sort of thing. What did it do to the fabric and the character of the city? I guess it alters it in a sort of inexorable way.
I suppose, in a way, Nazism perverted Berlin and Germany. One, of course, has to put it in historical context, the defeat in the First World War, the Versailles Treaty, the 1920s, the economic crash. They all hit Germany so hard. And I think in 1932, 30% of men were unemployed. Of course, that's the time of Isherwood and the Golden Twenties and cabaret and all that floss. And that was on the surface. But underneath, it was a desperately, desperately sad and sick place. And Hitler and Goebbels, in Germany as a whole and in Berlin, they took advantage of that. How did it mark the city? The city, in many ways, those marks have been removed apart from the physical marks.
You write in the book about the sort of that 20th century chapter of history and say, you know, it wasn't sort of one wartime. It was the 75 years from 1914 through to 1989, sort of suffering like few other places had to endure, and yet still such a creative spirit. Where does that come from, do you think?
I think that's a resilience. It's just a resilience in the Berliners. That's the simple answer. I think to take that a bit further, one of the things I'm intrigued about is, why is Berlin so popular now? You know, it's not the most comfortable place to live in Germany. It's not the most luxurious. It's not the most cutting edge. But why is it so popular? And I think this comes out of the idea of Berlin having always been a volatile place. It's always been in constant revolution. It's new guys. It has reinvented itself almost as a virtual city in bricks and mortar. Berlin is egalitarian, communicative. It doesn't have a single center, just like the internet. In other words, bricks and mortar Berlin has itself become a kind of network across which visitors and residents interact, party, surf. And it's that our interconnected young or young at heart generation which is most loving Berlin today.
You write about David Bowie and his time there in the sort of late 70s. You know, he was fascinated by writers who studied sort of change. You talk about being intrigued by metamorphosis. That idea of reinvention is really at the heart of the book. And is it Berlin also about being yourself and kind of finding yourself? Is it a city where you can really find yourself to be at home?
The individual goes there. And yeah, maybe he's not a Christopher Isherwood, or maybe she's not Marlene Dietrich. But in a small part of that city, they can recreate themselves and create a small world around them, or if they're successful enough, so the whole damn world, which reflects their imagination, which reflects their recreation of themselves. So yes, it is a place where you can find yourself. It is a place where you can create yourself or recreate yourself, maybe in the way the city mirrors the individuals.
That's Rory MacLean, author of Berlin, Imagine a City, talking to me a little earlier. This is Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, 1848 here in London. We'll pause for some music. We'll stay in the German capital, though, now, painted so beautifully by Rory in his book. One of the protagonists in there is David Bowie. He was there in the 1970s. His time in the city gave us this unforgettable number. It Could Only Be Heroes.
I wish I could swim.
The unmistakable sound of Heroes by David Bowie there. And as we tick towards the top of the programme here at Midori House, we'll have a little bit more music for you right after this. Yes, there's time at the end of Midori House to have our daily review. And today I'm delighted to welcome to the studio Mattis with Norwegian curator and producer. Mattis, great to have you with us, as always, on the programme. Now, I know you've got a few tracks you're going to talk about. We'll take a listen to some of those in a minute. But I guess just to talk about the sort of Nordic music scene first up, big conference, Bylarm, of course. Tell us sort of what goes on there. And I guess what's the kind of health of the Nordic music nation at the moment?
Oh, wow. I guess it's kind of a nation. I think we there's a lot of sort of similar musical genres and styles going on. So Bylarm is the yearly conference that gathers all of the most exciting acts from Finland, Iceland, Denmark, Sweden, and Norway for 1 week in Oslo. And there's 100 like handpicked bands curated by the best festivals from different territories. And it gathers a big international crowd. Sort of what's going on to watch what's going on in Nordic music.
Yeah. And does it do a good job, I guess, at sort of launching, you know, acts who are maybe just about to break internationally? Is it really good at kind of getting their names out there all around the world?
I definitely think it's the go-to destination when it comes to looking at what's going on in the different Nordic music scenes. Mm. Yeah.
Good stuff. One to watch, a scene to keep a close eye on then. But let's talk a little bit about some of the tracks that we're going to discuss in more detail. We'll start in Denmark, in Copenhagen. Lower. Tell me a little bit about them.
Yeah, so Lower, I guess it's one of the most sort of interesting young punk bands out there. They come from very quite politically charged punk scene in Denmark. I guess there's a little backstory to it. I was sort of stuck at a corporate event in Copenhagen, and their sort of manager said, should we get out of here? And we did, and he sort of drove me outside the city into this sort of industrial area where all these kids sort of own a house called Mayhem. It's like a punk house. So I go in there, and there's all these beautiful young people watching different punk concerts. And I guess the seminal moment of that night was when Lower goes on. And instead of sort of dancing around like you normally do at punk shows, everyone sort of freezes, and it's just this utter sort of silence when they're playing. It was a really like charged moment of just everyone sort of staring down the vocalist in his eyes while he was walking around the crowd sort of singing the lyrics into their faces.
Wow, it sounds incredibly intense. So let's take a little bit of a listen. I think the song we've got is But There Has to Be More. Let's take a listen now. That's a brief little snippet of But There Has to Be More from Lower. Part of this kind of new wave. It's interesting you talk about that sort of scene in Copenhagen. We've already seen other sort of punk acts coming through. Do you think it's a real possible sort of big breakout year maybe for Lower and for that whole sort of movement in the city?
I definitely think so. I think there's a big breakout year for Danish politically charged art and music in general. You know, you have this young guy talking about it. You have a lot of, you know, pretty strict government when it comes to immigration and a lot of different things. So there is a lot of things to be angry about. And I definitely see that reflected in the local art scene.
It's great they're articulating it in such a compelling way. Let's talk about the next artist. This is an album that was produced by PJ Harvey's producer, John Parrish. Innocence is Kinky, an amazing sort of lyricist and vocal artist. Tell us about her.
Yeah, this is Jenny Wall coming up. She's one of the more sort of interesting pop artist to come out of Norway in a very long time. She sort of alternates between the really brash and painful and the really sweet. So it's sort of her music is looking at the dynamic between the two and also the contrast between the two within the same song. And that's sort of what makes her music interesting and really stand out in the crowd.
Mm. Oh, you can see perhaps the sort of the PJ Harvey production values in there as well. Let's take a listen. This is the eponymous song from the Innocence is Kinky album. Here it is.
Live there and burn. I go out
That's Jenny Val with Innocence is Kinky. I could really see that one being a sort of breakout in sort of across Europe, US as well. Big things ahead, do you think, for in the coming few months?
Definitely. She's going on tour with a pretty seminal punk band called Swans. So I definitely think they will help her sort of further reach out to the people that haven't already been familiar with her.
Great sound, definitely. Let's finish up. Let's go to Sweden. A techno producer brought his friend and cousin along to make something of a hybrid track. Just describe this one to us.
So this is sort of the weirdest sort of Scandinavian pop songs I've heard in a long time. It's sort of messed with Italo disco cliches mixed with sort of a wedding singer karaoke style production. It's a pretty conflicting band watching live. It's very lo-fi and kind of embarrassing while really catchy at the same time. And I sometimes think embarrassing music is the best pop music.
I might agree with you on that. Let's take a listen and see what our listeners make of it. But now put me down, place me on my whipping board, start talk about emotions. Now put me down, place me on my whipping board, start talk about emotions. Well, I like that. I don't know if that was embarrassing or not, but I definitely like that one. Remind us who that was and what they'll be up to at the moment.
They're called Mantir. This track is called Outside Amore. It's coming out on LCD Sound System, James Murphy's label, and it's a full length to be heard this year. It sort of sounds like Drake meets Swedish wedding singer.
Great description. That is Outside Amore. Great track to close that review. Matt Smith, the Norwegian creator and producer, thanks very much for joining us here on Midori House. That is all we have time for. It's been a busy show today. Special thanks to Mathis and to my guests, Martin Plaut and Robert Fox, a little earlier. The show was produced by Thomas Lewis. Research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Sean Malervi. We'll be back at the very same time tomorrow, 1800 hours London time, with another edition of Midori House. Until then, it's goodbye from me.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.